Part U, sentence. Pilate is manoeuvred into condemning Jesus to death, but publicly disowns responsibility.
The time soon came when Pilate strode outside and faced the priests who'd wanted to condemn Jesus the Christ as common criminal. The Lord remained indoors under guard, while Pilate made it clear he'd found no fault, and nor indeed had Herod Antipas, in the strange man they seemed to hate so much. I'll therefore have him whipped and set him free. The outrage that he faced from priests and scribes surprised the procurator, till it dawned on him that envy was the motive that was driving them to yell out in disgust their wish to have him forthwith crucified. He would appeal to others in the crowd, those who had more to gain and less to lose. For most, the Nazarene was not a threat. He undermined the power and influence of Caiaphas and Annas and the rest. That was the reason for their hate of him. Thus, hoping to appeal to those who stood and waited for the judgment he'd pronounced, who had no axe to grind, Pilate announced, "I have two men on trial. Which of them would you prefer I should release? Jesus or the man Barabbas? Whom shall I free?" "Barabbas!" was the shout. "Let him go free! And Jesus, what of him? Crucify him!" This perhaps well-motivated auction, for that is what it turned out to be, was quite unjustified. Effectively, it classed the man whom he had wished to free as criminal and not as innocent. In the same breath, he could be spoken of as someone who had murdered and rebelled against the Roman rule. This was unjust. What's more, the plan came instantly to grief. The high priest's party had made sure that folk, despite the early hour, had been induced, cajoled, prevailed upon, and organized in such a way that Pilate would believe the orchestrated baying of the crowd must represent the feelings of the Jews in general, not only that of priests. When Pilate still seemed likely to reject the cause for Jesus to be crucified, he faced the likelihood that there would be a riot. And besides that, something else, a subtler threat. There might be a complaint made to the emperor himself, no less. A group of Hebrew notables might make the trip to Rome to tell Tiberius, to tell him what? A priestly voice yelled out above the noise, "Jesus proclaimed himself a king. If you release this man, you are siding with enemies of Caesar. One who dubs himself a monarch is a threat to Rome." Maestas populi Romani. That was a principle of Roman rule, the preservation of the dignity and superiority of Romans everywhere. Since Tiberius was the state, he could take the insult personally. The governor indeed had much to fear. This would not be the first complaint. A list of briberies, of wanton injuries, of tantrums, theft, injustice, and much else had reached the ears in Rome. This priestly straw might break the camel's back. Pilate took stock. The longer he delayed, the more the crowd displayed the likelihood there'd be a riot. "Fetch me a bowl," he ordered hurriedly, "with water and a towel." When this was done, in full view of the crowd, he washed his hands and from his judgment seat he solemnly disowned responsibility for what he was about to do. "I'm not to blame for shedding this man's blood," he said. "You are." "The guilt shall fall on us and on our race, upon our children and their children too," was the reply. Thus Jesus was condemned. We are not told of Pilate's wife's response. Her husband had caved in. Jesus must die. He spoke the customary formula, "Ibis in crucem," which translated meant, "You will ascend the cross." And from then on, normal procedures were in place. Not quite. That was not all. Pilate devised a way of sneering at the Jews whose cleverness had outmaneuvered him. Jesus had been condemned because, they said, he claimed to be a king. He'd demonstrate the kind of king that they deserved, as trash, as conquered race, as underlings, who would forever be inferior beneath the Roman rule. The soldiery could be relied upon. They would devise some way to make his point. The crucifixion ritual began. A scourging was the normal overture, preliminary to the death ordained. Many were killed before they reached the cross. Whips, reinforced with metal or with bone, could lacerate the entrails of a man and lay them bare. The lash was merciless. Then add to this the blows and buffetings that Jesus had already undergone, and you may glimpse, if glimpse you dare, the man the soldiers dressed in bloodied scarlet robes, the man to whom they gave a walking stick, a cane-like reed, pressed into his right hand, as if this symbol of fragility were carried like a scepter to proclaim he was, in fact, a man of royal power. And finally, to cap this cruel charade, someone had woven from a wayside shrub a crown. The plant had sharply vicious thorns which, keen as razors, cut into his brow and scraped his scalp as it was rammed askew to add more weight to his indignities. The game was not yet over. Hastily, the men of Pontius Pilate's personal guard, all ranks of that prestigious corps, turned out to bawl and whoop and cheer and make a noise as if the victim were an emperor. They shouted loud hurrahs, "Hail, King of Jews!" And when they cheered and bowed and bent the knee, they spat at him and took his scepter stick to batter him upon his thorn-crowned head. At last they all grew tired of the game, stripped Jesus of his finery, and dressed him once more in the clothes that he had worn. They put the beam to which he would be nailed into his helpless hands and pointed him the way to Golgotha. Try as he might, he could not carry it. He was too weak and fell beneath its weight. No one would help. No one would suffer the indignity. The feast of Passover, when work was banned, was hours away. The soldiers could use force to press-gang someone to pick up the plank without incurring too much local fuss. It was a stranger whom they seized upon. His name was Simon. He could not refuse. He was a Libyan, a Greek or Jew from Cyrenaica, as it was known till recent history. Cyrene, then. The crowds, who always followed in the wake of Jesus, followed him that day. Women bewailed his sufferings and the bitter end that now confronted him. The Lord turned round and begged them not to weep for him, but for themselves. The future held for them alarms beyond description and beyond belief. The place for crucifixion was well marked. Posts that were firmly fixed already stood. The transom Simon carried was put down. The hands of Jesus, or his wrists, were nailed to either end as he lay on the floor. The crosspiece then was fastened to the post, and to the post the soldiers nailed his feet. Not even this was disrespect enough, for kings appear with regal counselors. Two were provided, one on either side. Robbers, rebels, part of the daily crop of those condemned to face this cruel death. The road to Golgotha was very short, a matter of just several hundred yards. The word denotes in Hebrew the skull's place. It lay within the sight of city walls, and gained the name because a nearby hill was shaped in such a way as to suggest a human skull, not because skulls were left. Once they were dead, the crucified were moved. Accounts do differ, but we shall assume that at midday, the Nazarene began the sharp, fierce agony towards his death. Yet he was heard to say, fighting for breath, "Forgive them, Father. They are unaware of what it is they do. Forgive them all." As was the Jewish custom of the time, he had been offered myrrh stirred into wine as a narcotic that would numb the pain, but this he had refused. Meanwhile, the squad who served that day as executioners were taking their panicularia. The Emperor Hadrian had confirmed the right of soldiers to take all the clothes of one whom they'd been ordered they must crucify and share them. On this day, they hit a snag. Between the four, most of his clothes could be divided without argument or fuss, but his undergarment was expensive and woven, like a high priest's, without seam. They had to have recourse to casting lots. With sticks of various lengths? Or dice? Who knows? The women who had come from Galilee and followed him so faithfully so long were weeping at a distance. Only four of them and just one man came close to him. They were his mother Mary at his feet, her sister, and the wife of Cleopas, another Mary, plus the Magdalena, the Mary from Magdala by the lake. And John was there, who was to write this down. To him the Lord entrusted the sole care of his beloved mother in her grief and in her loneliness. "Here is your son," he said to her. To John he said, "Here is your mother, John." And willingly, from then, he took her home with him and treated her with honor, with concern, and with respect. Above each cross there was a titulus, a note to justify the victim's fate. Above the cross of Jesus could be read a scroll in Hebrew, Latin, and in Greek. "Jesus the Nazarene, the King of Jews." It was a studied insult, Pilate's work. The Jews raised angry voices to protest. "You should have written, 'This man falsely claimed that he was King of Jews.'" for otherwise it might be understood he represents as criminal the best of all our race. Well, take it as you wish. It's written now, was Pilate's answer. He had scored a point. The place was overlooked by passers-by. Derisive catcalls came from those who passed. Things like, "If you're the Son of God, come down. If you'd rebuild the temple in 3 days, what could be easier? You called yourself the Son of God. Well, all we want is proof." One of the two men crucified with him joined in the chorus of complaint and cried, "If you're the Christ, then save yourself and us." But his companion would have none of this. "We are condemned for wrongs that we have done. This man is guiltless. Lord, remember me the moment that you find you are a king. Today, you will be with me in paradise," was Jesus' reply. About this time, the light began to fail, the cause perhaps a dark and sand-filled desert wind, known now as Khamsin, which could change the day to night. It caused the earth to shake and buildings swayed. A major earthquake seemed to be on hand. Rocks cracked, graves opened, and the temple veil, the valance at the threshold of the room known as the Holy Place, was split from top to bottom. It was early afternoon. For those upon the cross, the pain grew worse. A phrase in Aramaic rent the air. "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani." Jesus was praying in his mother tongue, a psalm of David which begins, my God, why have you left me on my own?" Someone who knew no Aramaic thought he called upon Elijah and proposed they wait, in case the prophet should appear, to rescue him. But no help came. He called again. "I'm very thirsty," he exclaimed. A soldier fixed a vinegar-soaked sponge onto his javelin's point and passed it up until it reached the sufferer's mouth and lips. It was the 9th hour, almost 3 o'clock, impenetrably dark, when Jesus said, "It is all over now. It has been done." And calling out, "Father, into your hands, my spirit, I entrust," he breathed his last.